Hi, everybody. Geraldo here. Welcome to Geraldo Rivera, the podcast. If this is your first time listening, thank you very much for tuning us in. Every week or so, I'll give you my thoughts, my opinions on the air, on the latest news. There's so much to talk about now in the age of Trump. You can have show notes if you need them. They can be found on my website, geraldo.com. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also follow me on Twitter at Geraldo Rivera and on Facebook, Geraldo Rivera. All these links are in the show notes. Again, thanks for tuning us in. Here now the show. This is podcast number 17. I'm Geraldo Rivera. Thank you very much for tuning in. Aside from marking and honoring Cinco de Mayo, there's a lot going on. Obviously, I mean, there's some schmucky things that happen with Cinco de Mayo. I mean, in Baylor University, this is true. In Baylor University, one of the fraternities in Baylor University, great sports teams. But as you know, many of them got in a jam for failing to report sexual assaults or so forth there at Baylor. Anyway, one of the fraternities at Baylor, they dressed up as Mexican immigrants and were chanting, "Build that wall, build that wall." Obviously a reference to the Trump campaign slogan. So the fraternity was suspended from the campus, as it should have been. Certainly it should have been admonished in some dramatic fashion. But it is a real weird time to be celebrating Cinco de Mayo. Of the 11% of the American population, they say now that there are about 5 million, 6 million of the 11 million undocumented in the country come from Mexico. Fewer now than in previous years, more from Central America than and from Asia, the Philippines, China, and so forth, than from Mexico. But Mexican Americans have played an incredibly important role in the development of American history. You know, it's funny. I mean, this wasn't what I was going to talk about, but you know how the Civil War, if you come from the South, the Civil War, if you're a young man in the South, I remember Tom Wicker, a writer, a famous writer for the New York Times, now deceased. I think he's deceased. Anyway, I don't wish him ill, but I remember Tom Wicker reading him religiously back in the 60s and 70s. And he wrote that in Southern lure, in the American South, for young men and boys, history is frozen on July 3rd, 1863, just before Pickett's charge at the Battle of Gettysburg, which doomed the failure of which doomed the Confederate cause. But it is amazing how the Confederacy, the myth of the Confederacy and the antebellum South and the time before the defeat in the Civil War, how so many Southerners still cling to that tradition, despite the fact that it is so long ago. It is still almost a living part of history. The South, the Confederacy, the pre-Emancipation Proclamation, slavery, and so forth. That's 1860. 1861 starts the Civil War. Well, 1860 with the secession of South Carolina, then 1861 with the firing on Fort Sumter and the awful battle in which maybe 600,000-700,000 Americans on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line were killed in conflict or died as a result of the Civil War. So it's still alive. The Civil War is still alive. And yet, and this brings me back to Cinco de Mayo, what people don't nearly know quite as dramatically is that up until 1846, in other words, just 14 years before South Carolina seceded from the United States and started the process that ended up in the Civil War, 14 years before that, up until 1846, much of the current United States was still part of Mexico. In other words, Texas went in 1836, I think it was, but in the 1830s, Texas declared independence. Texas had been part of Mexico, but it was the result of the U.S.-Mexican War that New Mexico, the state of New Mexico, Arizona, California, Some of what is now Oklahoma and Colorado and Utah and Nevada were all part of Mexico, all part of the Republic of Mexico. So here you have this big flap. I bet you didn't know that. Or you don't think of that. One-fourth of the United States was part of the Republic of Mexico until 1846, the defeat of Mexico by the United States. So just 14 years before the United States Civil War, one-fourth of the United States was part of Mexico. And Mexicans aren't allowed to have nostalgia about that. It's not like, it's an illegitimate kind of thought, historical thought. Oh, well, that used to be part of Mexico. I'm not crossing over the line to get into the United States. The line crossed over me when the United States conquered the southwestern portion of America and made it part of the United States. So it's funny how you can have nostalgia for the American South. You know, white guys can have all kinds of nostalgia for the rebels and the rebel yell and Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee and all the rest of that, history and myth. But for a Mexican to say, Arizona used to be part of Mexico just 14 years before the American Civil War began, that's like a big no-no. But no one talks about that. It's an illegitimate thought, that strong historic claim that in and of itself should make of Mexican immigrants a favored group, shouldn't it? I mean, it used to be their great-grandfathers, but it doesn't. And I'm not going to argue that. But on this Cinco de Mayo, I merely state it, that there are strong, strong historic ties between Mexico and the United States, go far beyond, and Canada also in a different context. But the U.S. and Mexico have long historic ties, roots that go down very deep. But Cinco de Mayo, celebrate. My daughter Isabella and her friends are... they'll be drinking margaritas, I assume. She's of age, 24. She works here at Fox. So have a happy and safe Cinco de Mayo. What I want to talk about today, though, doesn't concern that so much as it concerns my friend, the 45th president of the United States, Donald Trump's first legislative triumph. The House Republicans, under the leadership of Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, did manage to pass the Republican version of a health care act. I congratulate Donald Trump on that because that was truly the art of the deal. Put aside the substance of what the House Republicans voted in favor of and passed. Put that aside yesterday. Put that aside and just talk about what was accomplished by Donald Trump. But for his intervention, but for his practicing of the art of the deal, There would never have been the Obamacare replacement, repeal and replacement bill. He, through arm twisting and face-to-face negotiating, managed to get this, it's like herding cats. They had the Freedom Caucus, the hard right caucus, you had the Tuesday group, you had the Thursday group, you had all these different groups within the Republican caucus, within the House GOP. Donald Trump managed with very few dissidents to get all of these Republicans together to vote and narrowly pass the repeal and replacement of Obamacare. So I really congratulate Donald Trump. And what I would love to do is to watch him use that kind of skill, to watch him use this incredible ability he has to negotiate, to really go to the Middle East as he is going in his first foreign trip coming up soon, to the Israeli-Palestinian. He's going to Saudi Arabia, but he met with Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, to really try to sit with the Israelis and sit with the Palestinians and make peace. If anyone can do it, and that's one of the reasons I was relatively optimistic about Donald Trump's presidency, because I think that almost unique in the American political sphere, he has the ability to bring people together and to negotiate deals. And I would love to see him the same way he herded those Republican mavericks together to vote in favor of the Republican repeal and replacement of Obamacare. I think that he could apply that in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He could deal with Iran and open up the the relationship with Iran in a real way. It's a wonderful, you know, the old Persian Empire. You go to the southwestern part of the United States, you go to L.A. nowadays. The Shahs of Sunset, they're really a high-functioning group of folks, and I'd love to have better relationships between Iran and the United States, and Donald Trump's the guy to do it. North Korea, the fact that he reached out to Kim Jong-un, and people said, oh, my God, how can he deal with Kim Jong-un? He's a dictator, he's a totalitarian, he's this, he's that, or the way he reached out to the Filipino leader. To me, these strongmen in North Korea, in the Philippines, and in many, many other countries. Certainly, when you think back to Iraq, when Saddam Hussein was in charge, Libya, when Muammar Gaddafi was in charge, Egypt, when Hosni Mubarak was in charge, and indeed even Syria with Assad in charge, with those strongmen, fewer civilians were being massacred. Strongmen are better than anarchy in the context of many, many of these situations around the world. And for Trump to reach out, you make peace with your enemies. You don't make peace with your friends. That's what people have to really grasp. That by being friends with the Filipino strongman or the, talking to Putin in Moscow or Xi in China, these strongmen, let their country sort out who they want to lead them. The United States can be a moral guide, but to try clumsily to intervene in other people's affairs the way Putin is alleged to have interfered in ours, I think that let Trump use these tremendous negotiating skills. He could moderate this conduct. He could mitigate some of these abuses, but he can use the stability provided by a strong man like the Filipino president to strengthen the hand of the United States in the Asia-Pacific region and make the world a better place for the United States and for people everywhere. I mean, I just think that Trump has amazing skills, as demonstrated by this healthcare repeal and replacement. Now, the substance of the deal, I think, is really lame. I mean, going back to, yes, I'm proud of the president that he used his skill as a negotiator to get the Republican House united behind the Republican president. That's great that he used his skill to have a legislative triumph. The downside, the tragedy in the triumph, that mask, the smile and the frown. The frown side is that he used this great negotiating skill to pass a bill, in the House that I feel is very regressive, very unfair. Yes, it helps young, healthy people. And yes, it helps save taxes for affluent Americans. But it totally screws people with pre-existing conditions in some of these states that are going to opt out of coverage of pre-existing conditions. It's going to hurt people who need the help the most. It's really going to shaft poor people and really reduce their access to quality, affordable health care. I think the Republicans will pay the price for passing this bill. As much as I admire the president's legislative skill or skill in influencing legislators, I should say, I think the Republican plan saves money for rich people. It's going to cost the U.S. Treasury money. I think it's a cruel bill in many ways. And from a practical point of view, I think the Republican plan will have the net effect of costing the Republican seats in the House of Representatives come the midterm elections in 2018. Because they will be able to campaign. They'll show, here is Mary Johnson, and Mary Johnson had cancer or diabetes or pick your disease, and she ran out, her insurance ran out, or she couldn't get insurance and this and that, her little baby, the Jimmy Kimmel baby. What if it wasn't Jimmy Kimmel? It was somebody else's little baby that couldn't afford the elaborate heart operation, series of operations and so forth. I think that the Republicans will have to run against those tragic anecdotes of people who have died or have been, in other ways, severely disadvantaged by the Republican plan. So to summarize, the president who is wearing the mantle of president of the United States far more comfortably now. You've got to admit that when you see him now speaking as president of the United States at some international gathering or even giving a trophy to a sports championship, championship trophy to the winners of this pro sport or that college sport. I think that he's really stepping up to the plate when it comes to the stylistically being more presidential. I like that. I don't like the fact that this first major triumph is a healthcare plan that I think will rebound very negatively against Republicans in the midterm election. You know, it's funny that not many people that I know are pining for the days of Barack Obama. I really think that he was terrific and will be regarded as an underrated president. But one thing he did, interestingly enough, you know, the guy Macron in France, the moderate business guy, a centrist, Barack Obama endorsed the French centrist candidate for fear that Marine Le Pen, the hard right-wing French candidate, would win this election. The way Donald Trump won our election, the way the Brexit people voted to get the United Kingdom out of the European Union. So Barack Obama endorsed the centrist over the hard right winger. Isn't that interfering in a foreign election? I mean, what's the difference between Barack Obama interfering in the French election or intervening, endorsing a French candidate, and Putin interfering in our election or effectively endorsing Donald Trump in the U.S. election? You know, it's kind of funny to me that when Barack Obama does it, the left wing is silent. When Donald Trump does it, whatever Donald Trump does, he has the worst relationship with the press of any president, at least since Richard Nixon. And even Richard Nixon, with the his anti-press stance, it really only got bad after he got in a jam in the second of his two terms, the one that was shortened by the Watergate scandal. But Donald Trump has the worst relations with the press of anybody, at least going back to Richard Nixon, maybe ever. So I don't believe that it's fake news. I think that's a bunch of BS. I think that his attacks on the press, Mr. Trump's attacks on the press, are unfortunate. But you cannot deny that the guy's got the worst press of any president in living memory, certainly at least going back to Richard Nixon and the heart of Watergate. One thing I want to say about healthcare, the way I feel about it, and be very, very clear about this, I think that the Obama plan was a modest plan. I mean, now the Republican plan is even stingier than the Obama plan. I mean, the Obama plan forced young, healthy people to buy insurance so that they were, in fact, subsidizing the older, sick people. But what I think has to happen is the country has to subsidize healthcare for everybody. I believe in a single payer. I believe that's the direction we are headed. I want Medicaid for everybody. Health shouldn't be a function of income. I mean, if you are a billionaire, you should have the same Medicaid as the homeless guy. If you want on the side, pay cash for, a boutique doctor to give you a first-class royal suite when you go to the hospital and have six surgeons instead of one operating on you. If you want to get a plastic surgery, get a nose job, a chin job, a hair job, whatever you want, that's fine. But I think everybody should have basic health care provided to them by the federal government. A single payer, everybody, just like in when the president was with the guy from Australia, right? He's with the prime minister from Australia. I forget his name. What's his name? I feel stupid now. I forgot the name of the Australian leader. But he praised, what's his name? You looking it up? I feel, Aussies, don't be mad at me. Especially not my boss. My boss is. Turnbull, that's it, Malcolm Turnbull. He praised Malcolm Turnbull's, he praised Australia's healthcare system, saying that Australia had a better healthcare system than the United States. Duh, of course it does. It's a single-payer system, like Canada, like the United Kingdom. Health shouldn't be a function of who lives and who dies. It shouldn't be the rich should live and the poor shall die. It should not be that. I believe we should have a single payer. So let me summarize. I think that Cinco de Mayo, we celebrate the Battle of Puebla and the victory over the French. That's good. We salute the 11.1% of the U.S. population that is of Mexican descent. That's 35.8 million people, at least as of 2015. We congratulate the president on his legislative triumph. Oh, incidentally, one thing that I have been watching with great interest and some hope is this deal hammered out by Russia, Turkey, and Iran to set up these de-escalation zones in Syria. I have long argued for safe havens within Syria where Sunni Muslim Syrians can go and be safe from their Shiite Muslim leaders. You know, that's basically a religious war in Syria. I would love to see a kind of a Sunnistan where within Syria you had these foreign forces protecting Sunni Syrians from danger, from death, from murder and mayhem. I like that idea. We're watching it. Donald Trump is also watching it. But I would love to see the United States more directly involved in solving this bloodletting in the Syrian conflict. We're cheering on the forces of Iraq, helped by the U.S. Special Forces and other U.S. Allies in the battle for Mosul in Iraq. I see now they opened a second front, a northern front in the city of Mosul. Craig and I were almost killed outside of Mosul. We were in a car. We were approaching. We were going to visit the Stryker Brigade, which had replaced the 101st Airborne. It was 2004, 2005. There was a bloody, bloody time in Iraq. We were in a convoy, and our car got hit 14 times by a sniper. We had a hardened vehicle, not quite bulletproof, but certainly bullet resistant. But we later pried the slugs from I was obviously an AK-47. Someone just sprayed our vehicle, hit us 14 times. It was like sledgehammers hitting the vehicle. I remember it so clearly. But anyway, that was 12, 13 years ago. Now they're still fighting in Mosul, Iraq. We're cheering on the Iraqi forces. We want them to get rid of ISIS, get rid of ISIS in Syria, get rid of ISIS in Iraq. I think the whole world will be a lot better off, and I would love to see that happen. The healthcare legislation, sad. I'm sorry we're going in that direction. I'm sorry that we're, the Republicans have given the enemies of the president some ammo to use in the midterm elections. But the president, again, looking much more presidential and behaving much more comfortable in his skin. He's here in New York today, but he's not staying in Manhattan because it costs so much money. Trump Tower, you should know, is right on Fifth Avenue between 56th and 57th Streets. It's right in the heart of Manhattan. It's right there by Bergdorf, by Bendel, by Van Cleef and Arpels, by Cartier, by all these highfalutin stores, and to have all these barricades there and to have all the cops there working on overtime, it's enormously expensive. I think Mayor de Blasio here in New York said it was $300,000 a day in overtime, police overtime. So anyway, the president is staying not here in New York, but Bedminster, his beautiful course out in central New Jersey. I actually was there at Bedminster with Eric and his beautiful wife, Laura Trump, raising money for St. Jude's. That was a wonderful occasion. Those kids really are very, very impressive. I'm glad they're holding up under the scrutiny. So that's about it. That's all I really have to say right now. Thanks very much for watching and listening. Have a great week. Bye-bye.